morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Welcome to Wonderland through the looking glass of 2020. Not palindromic like 2002, yet pertinent to visual acuity necessary to pierce through distorted mirages of cracked mirrors in the funhouse of America. The astigmatic myopia afflicting 2020 Americans is comparable to the purblind stigmata of the Iraq War of 2003. But it is not deja vu all over again just yet, with possible exception of reflating onerous illegal laws from then that are being dusted off and insinuated into current rubric. In particular, the USA Patriot Act is being resurrected, including the more grotesque portions of the Nixon-inspired proscription of dissent and protest known as the iniquitous Houston Plan, infamous for its illegal wiretapping, burglaries, kidnapping, and secret deporting of radical dissenters against the Vietnam War. Today is January 16th, 2020, in the here and now, but then is being transposed into now, dissembling now into then. Double barrel the zeros, and it is 2002 again. That was now. This is then. We start with the USA Patriot Act as diagnosed by KMUN's former vagabond volunteer, Aka Louis Olivas. The USA Patriot Act by Louis Olivas. I was pleased I was asked if I was interested in how our rights have changed since the institution of the so-called USA Patriot Act. Considering myself a son of liberty, I enthusiastically took the bait and delved into the smoky darkness that is the USAPA. I ran headfirst into a wall designed to discourage. It is a wall of elite language, an obfuscating fog of legalese and political cross-reference, a dense thicket of distractions. The act is formally called the Uniting and Strengthening of America by Providing Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism Act of 2001. It is, depending on format, 320 to 350 pages long and is quite frankly unreadable by anyone without enormous experience in legal and political writing and a lot of time on their hands. My first thought on seeing this entire document was skepticism that such an enormous document was assembled in just the 6 weeks following the atrocity of the Twin Towers. Further research has shown that many parts of this act were already written and in many cases had been rejected by the legislatures they were presented to. Much of this legislation dates back to the bombing of Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City in 1995. In the first flush of horror, many persons and authorities assumed this was the work of a foreign power, most likely Islamist, and the seeds of the USAPA were planted then, only to wither on the thin soil of evidence that told us this terrorist was an American citizen and veteran of the armed forces. But vigilance can be long-lived, and with the terror of 9/11, many parts of the USAPA were already researched, written, and waiting for the day when a hostile Islamic enemy threatened us. The language of the USAPA did not really surprise me. The language of law as it exists in America today is dynamically similar to the use of Latin in the medieval church. In both cases, the language used to describe and justify the actions of the rulers of these periods is not the language of the governed, but a specialized jargon kept secret except to its privileged and ordained elite. In those dark centuries, illiteracy served to keep the ruled ignorant of any idea except that of submission to the status quo. It spread and preserved the idea that the governed were there due to divine selection, and that a person's station in life was immutable. Our modern lingua cathedra is also unintelligible to the average citizen, rendering him or her functionally illiterate as regard the very laws she or he is supposed to rely on for safety and security. This illiteracy serves to keep the citizen ignorant of his or her true rights and usages and supports submission to the status quo. It spreads and preserves the idea that our governors are there because we ordinary people are ignorant in the face of this body of impenetrable language, language that is the private domain of our legal and political betters. However, unlike the submissive medieval peasants, there are many in our country that do have access to and use of this specialized cant. It is through the efforts of these persons and organizations that I have been able to find out some of what was changed and how some of those changes will affect us. One of the more clever methods in use by our new big brother, U.S. APA, is to take advantage of the fact that the framers of the Constitution never heard of telephones, computers, the Internet, etc. So many of USAPA's expanded powers focus on information flow, just as freedom of movement now relies almost exclusively on the use of automobiles, so our freedom to communicate relies on many electronic media. In the case of cars on roads, we are told that driving is not a right, but a privilege. Could such an argument be used against the Internet? Already, application from USAPA and associated executive orders suggest that computer use may be labeled as terrorist if they suggest coercion against the government of the United States or in any way impedes interstate commerce. In this light, a suggestion to mass email a federal office or boycott a transnational corporation may be declared a terrorist act. In addition to constitutional violations, the USAPA modifies at least 18 other federal laws. Most of these modifications specify that the executive branch make adjustments to these laws without either judicial review or legislative action. In the name of security from our terrorist enemies, the traditional checks and balance of our government are overridden, often allowing low-level federal functionaries to act without any responsibility to our legally constituted laws. My personal attention is drawn to usages that suggest that these structures are temporary, only existing, quote, for the duration of the emergency. But this emergency is so very adjustable. So long as there might be a few disgruntled persons with a gripe about American foreign policy, the emergency continues. Many politicians and members of the military-industrial complex have been looking for something to replace the evil empire of the old Soviet Union. The drug war has not been good enough. Peacekeeping in war-torn Somalia was at best a brief window for imperial expansion. Noriega, Grenada, Haiti, and even the Balkans were not long-lived enough or pervasive enough to justify a permanently enlarged military. But we have seen now that the war against Al-Qaeda has been expanded into conquest and puppet rule in Afghanistan, and as of this writing, the same process is aimed at Iraq. It has been said that war is the health of the state, quote unquote, and with a nebulous enemy such as militant Islam as the boogeyman, we can be assured of years of profitable business for the arms industry, the petroleum industry, and of course, the further expansion of the Pax Americana. It is also pertinent to note when we ask ourselves if we are to worry about being the focus of these acts and edicts, of the statements of the U.S. Attorney General. He was asked what the innocent American had to fear from increased security measures. His reply was, "The innocent are not suspects." As an attorney trained in logic, he must realize this statement is the equivalent of saying, "If you are a suspect, then you must be guilty." But there is some good news. A sunset clause in this legislation expires. It is not a repeal of the entire act or all of the executive emergency orders, but at least gives a brief window of opportunity to review some of these new legal constructs at that time. Better still, the TIPS program, designed to turn Americans into voluntary spies on their friends, neighbors, and coworkers, has been stalled by legislation and outrage of the public. And acting on proposals by Oregon's own Ron Wyden, the Senate put on hold the Total Information Act. This act, if ever initiated, would create an enormous national database wherein any transaction of any kind would be collected into a giant information bank to be used to detect patterns of terrorism or criminality. Every credit or debit card use, airline ticket, traffic summons, bills paid or unpaid, credit history, school record, birth certificate, social security account, employment record, and anything else you can care to imagine may be grist for this mill's work of making every act by every American part of a permanent criminal investigation. When 9/11 occurred, a wise man I know said that this may actually be the chance the USA has needed to waken the rank and file of Americans from the dark slumber of complacency. If any good can come of this tangle of imperial aggression and violent response, then it may be that the U.S. citizen will be roused to attention and action, and that once more we can be a leader of world peace rather than the newest in a string of aggressor powers. And that was the USA Unpatriot Act, written by Louis Alvis, who at the time he wrote it lived on a fish boat in Astoria. And a few years earlier, he was renowned as the Volunteer on KMUN-FM. And he wrote this in 2003 for the North Coast Times-Eagle. And he has a couple of addendums from the Bill of Rights, such as Amendment 1. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. Article 802 of the USA Patriot Act creates the new crime of domestic terrorism. This definition is so broad it can be used against persons trying to exercise their right to public demonstration if it appears to be intended to influence the policy of government by intimidation or coercion. And that's a quote. The Seattle World Trade Center protests of 1999, if held today, could be grounds to claim all participants are domestic terrorists. The same holds true for any public demonstration that does anything that might interfere with business as usual. Article 215 of the USAPA allows the FBI and or duly constituted agencies, quote unquote, of the law to seek records from bookstores and libraries regarding the reading or computer habits of persons suspected or claimed to be suspected of terrorism. It also gags persons who have asked to turn over said documents, making it illegal to mention they have been forced to comply. An attorney general edict now allows for surveillance of persons and organizations of a political or religious nature without any evidence of wrongdoing. It also lifts the restrictions against COINTELPRO-style operations, such as were used in the past for harassment or intimidation. Such operations are also permitted to set agents to infiltrate such gatherings and incite criminal behaviors. Another attorney general edict now states that freedom of information requests may be denied, even in the case of unclassified information. Don't ask, they won't tell, but they might be interested in who asks. A Bureau of Prisons emergency surveillance order allows for the authorities to listen in on the privileged conversations between a lawyer and client without having to get judicial approval. This holds true even in cases where there has been no finding of guilt. And Amendment 4 of the Constitution the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon pardonable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Section 203 of the USAPA allows the CIA to access information gathered by domestic law enforcement, including wiretaps and electronic media, without need of court orders or warrants. It can share that information with any other government agency and those of other countries. It is important to note that the CIA was established to operate extranationally and had to refrain from operations in the United States. Now they are able to use other law enforcement as proxy. USAPA 218. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act is changed to all the FBI to conduct secret searches and surveillance without probable cause, so long as an agent says foreign intelligence is relevant or plays a part in an investigation. No evidence of a crime is necessary. Amendment 6 of the Constitution. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. USAPA 412 reduces the standard of probable cause as regards foreign nationals, overriding habeas corpus or judicial review. Most of us are not foreign nationals, but it does open the door, providing legal precedents for the reductions of previous standards. A presidential order allows the Attorney General, Defense Secretary, and CIA Director to label citizens and non-citizens as enemy combatants, placing them in military custody, holding them in detention indefinitely, interrogating them, and denying them communication with outsiders or judicial review. Due process is overridden for such persons. The same presidential order allows military tribunals at the president's discretion. And that's just a few, or those are just a few examples of USAPA as against the constitutional of the Bill of Rights. And in somewhat the same vein, I'd like to read something I wrote, Sons and Daughters of Liberty. I have blamed the German people for Hitler and the Second World War until now. I didn't realize how helpless they could be to stop Hitler until Bush became president. And that was a statement by Josephine McCusker at the age of 90. She was my mother. The USA Patriot Act represents nothing less than an arrogant attempt to take over the U.S. government by a very ambitious cabal who wish supreme power domestically and globally. To do this, they intend to abrogate the very Constitution and Bill of Rights that are the foundation of this nation's democracy and which gave them the power to be the threat they are. They are the very people our ancestors warned us about when they conceived the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and made the people supreme rather than the government. Our ancestors had the courage to create this nation. It is up to its citizens to preserve it. Throughout the country, nearly 150 cities and counties have acted to do just that, successfully petitioning their local governments to defy the harshly undemocratic implications of the Patriot Act. Unfortunately, other cities have rejected their citizens' call to oppose the current attempt to annul the Bill of Rights. Astoria is among them. By what might be charitably called a flagrant act of legerdemain, the Astoria City Council trivialized the concerns of at least 400 of its local citizens who beseeched the council to certify the Patriot Act as unconstitutional. Instead, the council crafted its own proposal to defer the local Bill of Rights Committee to Oregon's federal representatives, a shabbily patronizing gesture at the very least, certainly a craven method of ducking a fundamental issue at the very core of the rights and liberties guaranteed by the Constitution, as well as a condescending display of disrespect for their constituents. The cop-out among the council was that, as elected officials, they had, quote, sworn an oath to the Constitution, unquote, and therefore could not vote in favor of the resolution, which called upon city staff to refuse cooperation with federal application of the Patriot Act within city boundaries. The irony is that if they really had respect for their oath, they would have stood up for the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, said Lee Miller, who attended the council meeting. If you list grievances our ancestors had against the British Crown, you will see that the Patriot Act enables our government to do those things on that list, Miller said. Our last refuge is local government, which affects 90% of our lives. Where do we go from there? Violence and revolution. I would prefer my revolutions to be peaceful, but what are the alternatives? And that was Lee Miller. One councilman suggested that the passionate hostility to the Patriot Act by the assemblage in the council chambers was based on fear. He was right. Aside from the council's own dread that it might actually have to do something, the real fear among the 200 persons at the meeting was that they are going to lose what is left of our democracy without having any meaningful opportunity to defend their basic constitutional rights. After all, the Patriot Act purports to amend the Constitution without having gone through the amending process prescribed by the Constitution, and also obstructs the customary method of revision or repeal acted against it. And that was something I wrote, Sons and Daughters of Liberty, for the North Coast Times Eagle, July 2003. And again, something I wrote, Is Wartime Dissent Patriotic? Quite often heard lately is the admonition that dissent should be restrained and even prohibited during time of war, that it might be acceptable prior to the start of a war, but equivalent to treason once a war has started. Dissent against wartime is harshly criticized as aiding and abetting an enemy. Yet now, when even friends and neighbors disparage dissent, is the essential moment to resist, to question with intelligence and vigorous skepticism the claims of a war's necessity and righteousness, and to protest the curbing of civil liberties that seem corollary to every war. The primary purpose for dissent in wartime is to discontinue wars inimical to the principles and liberties bedrock to this nation, and to critically scrutinize every stage of a war's conduct. If there were no dissent, the government would not feel compelled to publicly explain or attempt to justify its war making, nor recognize the civil rights of combatants and citizenry, but instead issue repressive edicts disguised as necessities for the war effort. And even with dissent, government generally stonewalls in reaction to public disquiet, which imputations of treachery are unable to fully squelch. Dissent is especially important when it is realized the reasons for war are misleading or hypocritical, which begs the question, is it truly unpatriotic to condemn lies that are as surely murdering Americans as any proclaimed enemy? It makes little sense to justify the debt of a war by sending more to also die, nor is it reasonable to curb dissent to war with the rationale it would prolong a war rather than pressure its end. Dissent in wartime is a necessary antithesis to the magnification of militarism war generates. The public is governed more by military doctrines and less by civic principles. The militant dominance of government and society erodes democracy to such a point that obedience rapidly supplants freedom of thought and expression as permissible patriotism. Wartime is not a time to be submissive or silent. Dissent is not a right, but an obligation for resolutely demanding veracity and integrity from self-styled war leaders and scrupulous adherence to constitutional values. And it might be argued that dissent refutes the claim that an entire society is manifestly responsible for the advent or conduct of a war and policies that lead to it. in a reframing of the concept that all members of a nation are guilty of whatever that nation does on the world scene. The liberties and freedoms within a society such as the USA dispute the contention of universal liability for total war. In that sense alone, dissent in wartime is our finest beacon. And that was something I wrote, is wartime dissent patriotic? And that was written during the Iraq War for the North Coast Times-Eagle in 2004. And now, to go back a little farther, I'd like to read as a poem, a song, War. And it's written by Barrett Strong and Norman Whitfield, and was famously sung by Edwin Starr. Oh no, there's got to be a better way. Say it again, there's got to be a better way. What is war good for? War has changed unrest among the younger generation. Induction, then destruction. Who wants to die? War. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Say it again. War. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Yeah, war. I despise, because it means destruction of innocent lives. War means tears to thousands of mothers. How, when their sons go off to fight and lose their lives, I said, war. We've got no place for it today. They say we must fight to keep our freedom, but Lord, there must be a better way. It ain't nothing but a heartbreaker. War, war, war. Good God, now, now give it to me one more time. Now, now, war. What is it good for? And that was War, sung famously by Edwin Starr. And on the subject of war, a personal note. 54 years ago this past Tuesday, on January 14th, 1966, I boarded a U.S. Navy troop ship in Long Beach, California, with about 500 other Marines bound for the Vietnam War, quite a few of whom returned stateside in body bags or bandages, crippled or shorn of limbs. Nobody got back unscathed, mentally mangled, poisoned by Agent Orange among a stew of chemical defoliants, disease also with malaria, dysentery, etc., plus lifelong PTSD of flashbacks and nightmares, especially during subsequent wars, and astronomical rates of suicide as the years pile up like corpses. 60 years ago, on January 5th, 1960, I began USMC boot camp in San Diego, California. This is Michael McCusker. I finished today's rant with a couple of poems. The first poem is one I wrote. Life spools out like a detached umbilical, or intestines blown through skin like a bomb. Protoplasm pulses, reverses, dissembles, love flashes, languishes. So years go, days diminish, years ago, yet morrows of memory resist maggots and mold. That was now, this is then, I think of you. And the second poem is by Elizabeth Hobbs, poet and teacher emeritus. The New Season. Last summer's rich blackberry vines trail in the mud of alley rain. It is the season of grit and thorns, catching at whatever happens by, giving back nothing but our own blood. It is the season of flood and tears. Nothing is ours, nor has ever been. Flesh ripped from loving flesh. We hear the rattle song of war. And that was Elizabeth Hobbs. She wrote that in December 2001. So adios, and tet for tat, happy year of the rat.